Ourselves again for the tape. We're talking today to William Isaac, former chairman of the FDIC, Kirsten Downey, K-I-R-S-T-I-N-D-O-W-N-E-Y, and Stephen Mintz, S-T-E-V-E-N-M-I-N-T-Z.
Yeah, and let me interject for a second. My grasp of technology is such that I think the tape recorder was not taping when you gave us an okay. So if I could ask you a third time, is it all right to tape this conversation?
Yes, it is all right to tape the conversation.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. And again, we're with William Isaac, and today is November the 18th?
19th.
November the 19th, and it is 3:37 now. I've just finished reading your book, which I thought was very interesting. And it talks about your feelings of dismay watching the events unfold in 2008. Could you talk a little bit about that for us?
Well, I believe that the government terribly mishandled the crisis and didn't give anywhere near enough heed to the importance of maintaining public confidence and trust in the financial system. I referred to it as a schizophrenic resolution process, where they would bail out Bear Stearns and then a week later let Lehman go down. And when I say bail out Bear Stearns, they didn't bail it out so much as they tucked it into J.P. Morgan Chase with a lot of government assistance, but it was a stabilizing transaction. It was reassuring to the markets to see that be handled in that manner. I think they could have handled it perhaps in even better manner by just addressing it as a liquidity problem, which is what it was. But in any event, they put it into safe hands and didn't wipe out creditors. And it did, I think, help stabilize the markets for a period. And then Lehman is teetering, and I think I don't have any question. Everybody was assuming the government would find a way to deal with Lehman the same way it did with Bear Stearns. And instead of doing that, it let Lehman drift off into bankruptcy. That was terribly destabilizing. The markets were in an uproar at that point. At the time, Secretary of Treasury Paulson said publicly that he didn't want to go down in history as the guy who bailed out Wall Street, and so he was not inclined to deal with. I mean, that's why he let Lehman go after the fact. He seems to be saying that they didn't have any legal authority, which I find hard to believe. If they could do Bear Stearns, I don't know why they couldn't do Lehman, and a few days after Lehman, they bailed out AIG, and which was a highly unusual transaction. I can't imagine how they get the legal authority to do AIG, which was an $85 billion loan secured by stock in the company, the stock of the company. I mean, I don't understand how they could think they had authority to do AIG and not Lehman.
Having been in Washington, can you not at all sympathize with the immense political pressure?
I understand the political pressure, but I think that people, that's one reason why you shouldn't have politicians making these decisions. There's a lot of political pressure, and the decisions generally have been made in prior crises, such as the 1980s when we had banking crises and the S&L crisis. The decisions were being made by independent agencies, the FDIC and the Federal Reserve, which are not unaware of the political pressures, but don't have to succumb to them. And I mean, I knew, for example, when we handled the failure of Continental Illinois in 1984, and in a way that was stabilizing, we protected the creditors. I knew that when we did that there would be congressional hearings and we'd be criticized for what we did. But that wasn't foremost on my mind. What was foremost on my mind was making sure that we didn't let the system become unstable. That if we had let Continental go down like they did Lehman this time, I have no doubt that there would have been a worldwide financial panic.
So you saw Continental Illinois as setting a precedent for similar crises with systemic banks at risk.
I was aware that what we were doing could have repercussions, and that people would be talking about too big to fail and the like. Yes, I was aware of that. I also didn't have any doubt that we had no choice, that if we had let Continental go down and fail, and creditors lose money, the uninsured creditors lose money, there is zero doubt in my mind that we would have had a worldwide financial panic, and we would have been in the Great Depression, much more serious than the Great Depression, because the largest banks around the world would have toppled.
Did you have any feeling going into 2008 that a crisis was looming?
I became uncomfortable when IndyMac went down, and I'm trying to remember the month. I believe it was somewhere around March of 2008. That maybe it was July. I think it was July. That IndyMac went down. It was a $35 billion thrift in California, mm-hmm. and the FDIC paid off the insured depositors and imposed losses on everybody else. Mm-hmm. That made the markets very nervous. I began to be concerned at that time, and I talked to regulators at the time to find out what they thought might be coming next, if anything. And I think the sense was, we hope this is we believe this is an aberration, this is an outlier, and we hope that's the case, but there are some institutions that are showing signs of weakness that we're concerned about, and the institutions that could be identified at that time, or were identified at that time, were WaMu and National City. I don't recall any conversation about Bear Stearns or Lehman, but WaMu and National City in the banking world were two that were identified as, we are nervous about them.
Right. So up until then, you hadn't thought that there was anything more serious looming.
I mean, of course you hear people, whenever you're in, you always have people who are the doom and gloom folks, and they're predicting the worst, no matter how bad it is. There are always a bunch of people out there predicting that it's going to get even a lot worse. And some of the statements that were made during this crisis I thought were quite irresponsible. But I wasn't, I mean, certainly I was aware that anything is possible, and that there were some people who were forecasting it would get a lot worse. But no, I would say that I believed in early 2008, to maybe almost to the midpoint 2008, I was still hopeful that we could have a soft landing, and I believe the regulators were of that view as well. And I mean, I know they were because I was talking with them.
Right. We've been joined by another person here. Mike, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Mike Easterly with the FCIC.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, I'm kind of, I guess, by default, the staff historian, and I was otherwise occupied, but I'm glad to be here.
Now, you, in your book, though, Mr. Isaac, you talked a lot about systemic problems in the financial system that you saw develop, accounting issues, regulatory issues, the loosening of the uptick rules, a number of things that you thought were problematic. Did you note them at the time, or is it only in retrospect, once the collapse came, that you put it all together?
Well, I don't think I put them all together in the sense that it was hard to believe how bad it would get, those were the things that I have criticized in the book, such as mark-to-market accounting. I was opposed to that from the 1980s on, I thought that we were headed toward that the next time we got into a serious problem, that mark-to-market accounting would exacerbate the problem. I also was a critic of prompt corrective action, which they adopted in response to the SNL crisis, where they denied the regulators the ability to use some discretion and judgment about which firms to deal with and when, and they tried to make it these automatic triggers just tying the regulators' hands. We used a lot of discretion in the 1980s to avoid having the system come unglued, and I believe prompt corrective action was a serious mistake. I was highly critical at the time in 1999 when the SEC took an enforcement action against SunTrust, saying that it was over reserving and manipulating its earnings upwards of all things. I thought that if you can't create reserves in good times, when are you going to create them? And I was highly critical of the Basel I and Basel II. I thought that they were weakening the U.S. capital standards, they're relying on backward-looking models. I testified before the Senate Banking Committee two or three times in opposition to the Basel II models. I resisted them when I was at the FDIC and wouldn't consider them.
What about your position on Glass-Steagall?
Glass-Steagall, as I said in the book, I thought that Glass-Steagall had been substantially weakened over the years with regulatory exceptions, and I thought that it was working pretty well, and I was in favor of going ahead and getting rid of it because I thought it would increase competition, and that we were smart enough to figure out how to regulate these firms. As I said in the book, I believe in hindsight that was wrong. It hasn't increased, it's actually diminished competition. It's created a lot more concentration in the financial system and it's clear we don't have a clue how to regulate these firms. So I think it was a mistake. As I said in the book, I would go back to the 1999. Law and put it back in place if I were king.
Okay.
The 1999 law, Gramm-Leach-Bliley,
or before?
Before.
I think he means
okay.
Before. Yeah.
All right.
Go before, back before that.
The 1999 was when they eliminated the vestiges of Glass-Steagall.
Right. No, I thought you said that he would prefer to go back to that law, which didn't make sense. But I see what you're talking about now.
It was a mistake to, in hindsight, it was a mistake to eliminate it in 1999.
Right, I understand.
And in this reform legislation, I actually wrote that that should be on the table, going back to the 1999 law.
Right. In terms of the quality, this is going to be a badly phrased question, but I'm wondering about the role of Congress and other regulators in regulation in the 1980s, what effect they had. And I can elaborate on that, but perhaps you have an answer already, or should I elaborate?
You should elaborate, because I'm not sure where you're going.
Okay.
But before you do that, could I just tie the last answer?
Oh, sure.
Because I mentioned a bunch of things. I mentioned quite a number of things, and there are more that that I was critical of at the time they were we went down the path toward mark-to-market accounting and the limiting of reserves and these pro-cyclical models and the like. And what I felt at the time those things happened that they were mistakes, and I was critical of them.
Were you openly critical? You mentioned once that you testified. Could you give us examples on the other things?
I've written articles for decades, and I wrote at least one, maybe more than one article criticizing the FDIC. In fact, I'm sure it was more than one, criticizing the SEC's action in 1999 with respect to SunTrust and the reserving issue. Basel II, I have been extremely vocal on. Mark-to-market accounting, I've been vocal on. But what I didn't realize was the full effect of all of it, and how, I mean, I knew it wouldn't be good when we got into the soup. Prompt corrective action, I was highly critical of it for years in writing. I couldn't estimate was if you put them all these things together, coupled with the government mishandling the failures of Lehman and others, the devastating power of all those things that, occurring at once, it was a tidal wave when you bring all these things together, when you destroy $500 billion of capital in the financial system because the markets simply stopped functioning because we mishandled Lehman and other institutions. It was really hard to envision just how bad that was going to be. I mean, I knew it was going to be bad. I didn't realize it would have as much power as it did.
Right. Now, what happened then is that you had been concerned about individual items as they unfolded, but then you're really shocked and watch the whole collapse in some shock. And then at some point you decide to come to Washington, and you talk about it a good bit in your book, but you felt very strongly that the TARP bailout was a mistake.
Yes, I wrote an article which was published in the Washington Post on September 27, 2008, in which I said, we don't need this law, we don't need taxpayer money, here's a four-point plan for how we can get this crisis under control without all that. I remain convinced to this day that TARP was a serious mistake, and we didn't need it, and it did far more harm than good.
And you also went to Capitol Hill and you spoke to Congress.
Well, I had a number of congressmen who called me up on that Saturday that the Washington Post article ran and said, "Will you come to Washington and talk with us? Because we don't like this TARP bill, and we need your input."
Yes.
And so, after I wasn't too keen on doing it, but I finally agreed to do it, and I did go up there, and we wound up being able to defeat it in the first vote in the House.
Right.
I probably talked to a few hundred congressmen, maybe a couple hundred or so, during that trip.
Yes. And you describe in the book how there was just so much political pressure growing for the bailout that it became impossible to stop it.
Well, I mean, there was a lot of pressure on members of Congress to change their votes and vote for it. When the House defeated it, the Senate took it up immediately and rammed it through. I don't know, there were probably four or five votes against it, and then the pressure was really put on a number of the members of the House to change their votes so that they could get it through the House, and they did. And the language that was used at that time was incredibly inflammatory, and I don't have any doubt that it had very significant impact on consumer confidence generally, and led to an even deeper recession than we would have otherwise experienced.
You also talk in your book about who seemed to be talking to who about it, and there's a long exchange where you talk about Timothy Geithner and how he handled who he was talking to during this period of time. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I looked at his phone logs that he turned over to the Congress, and for I believe it was for a 15-day period, I can't remember, from about mid September until the election, which was at the height of this crisis, and I looked at who he was talking to, and I was stunned by the amount of contact he was having with the Secretary of the Treasury, much more so than with his own boss, Ben Bernanke. I've never seen anything quite like that, where the Secretary of the Treasury is running the New York Fed in essence. And then I think there was a guy, I can't remember his name, I think it was Dan Jester, who was an aide to the Secretary of the Treasury, who had a large number of conversations with Geithner as well. And then I looked at all of the investment bankers, Goldman in particular, and I think I identified 400 or something like that. It's in the book, so you can use the real numbers, but
right.
People that were either with Goldman or had previously been with Goldman or were representatives representing Goldman. And I mean, it was stunning to me that there was that much input to the crisis management process by Wall Street firms, and when you add other large bank executives, it got up, I believe it was over 600. I can't remember. And I just found that stunning.
Yes.
I was chairman of the FDIC during a very severe banking crisis, and I never talked to bankers about how we ought to handle the crisis. I mean, I'm not saying I never talked to them, but I didn't talk to them 10, 15 times a day. And I would have gotten a variety of opinions, not just Wall Street. I was struck by the fact that he wasn't talking to anybody who had anything to do with Main Street. I couldn't find anybody on the list that I could identify. Well, that's somebody who understands how things happen in the Midwest. I didn't see any of that. I didn't see him talking to anybody who said, "Oh yeah, I know. This guy knows something about manufacturing." It was all the Wall Street financial titans, and I was quite surprised by that.
And I
obviously don't think it's appropriate.
Right. Did interesting. Did you think that was also true with the Fed? Do you know? Did you think the Fed was talking all the time? I mean, the Fed in Washington, or?
Well, I didn't have those. I mean, I don't know if they turned in phone logs, and I didn't have them in any event. But this was a New York Fed that I was looking at.
Yes.
I don't know what the people at I don't know who the Washington Fed was talking to, and I don't know who the Treasury was talking to. And that would be interesting to know that. And maybe you have those phone logs, and you can draw your own judgments.
Right. Is it your impression out of that Tim Geithner seemed to be playing a very important role in how the situation was handled?
When he's talking to the Secretary of the Treasury a couple hundred times in 15 days, or whatever the numbers were, that strikes me as a very large role he's playing in the thing. I was actually more concerned about the role the Treasury was playing. I mean, I found that stunning that the Treasury was running this crisis management process rather than the Fed.
And by that you mean because Treasury is political, is part of the White House.
It's a political agency, and it does not have the extensive experience that the Fed has.
Why do you think that could have happened?
I don't know. I hope you know more about that than I. But I would imagine that the Secretary of the Treasury just was a very aggressive in dealing with these things, and took the reins and ran the crisis management process. But that is that in prior crises that I'm familiar with, the Fed always played that role, not the Treasury. The Treasury was consulted. It wasn't, you know, they certainly had some input, but they didn't run the process.
Was it your experience when you were a public official that the New York Fed and the Fed board didn't always, or that sometimes the New York Fed went its own way as opposed to falling in with the Fed board?
Not really. The Federal Reserve banks are, I mean, they have their own charter, and
right.
and they have a board of directors, and they, you know, in the end they can make their own decisions, but generally there's a high level of cooperation and coordination. I think I noted in my book where we got into a dispute with the Chicago Fed on Continental Illinois about them wanting to take a security interest in all of Continental's assets, and you know, I was talking to Paul Volcker about that, saying they can't do this, Paul. We just did a transaction in which we assured everybody that the FDIC was going to protect everyone, and now the another branch of the government is going to say we need a security interest, and that's what we're trying to avoid. Is we don't want all the creditors running on Continental, and so that would just set such a bad precedent. And in the end, the Chicago Fed held tough, and they wouldn't back off of the position, and unless the FDIC gave them assurance that we would protect them, so we signed a private letter saying that we would protect them in the event that the bank failed, which I didn't have any particular problem doing that because we had already announced we weren't going to let the bank fail. So to me, that letter was should not have been necessary, but if that's what it took to get them on board, then so be it. But I give that as an example of where I think Paul Volcker didn't want the Chicago Fed to hold out for that letter, but he couldn't really order them not to, because they are their own. They have their own franchise, their own authority, and their own board of directors. So, but generally speaking, there was always a high level of cooperation between the Federal Reserve banks and the Fed in Washington and the FDIC. I mean, we argued about things from time to time and had differences of opinions, but we generally were very cooperative and got them resolved and moved forward.
How do you think things are going now?
In what sense?
How do you feel? Like, have you, well, of course, personally in Sarasota, you've been pretty hard hit by the problematic mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
And do you feel like that situation is resolving itself?
Well, I'm actually fairly discouraged right now about the status of things in the country, because we passed a reform law, which I'm sure if you've read my writings, you'll know that I don't think we reformed much, and we didn't solve any of the issues that led to this crisis, in my view, and this reform law would not have prevented the crisis we just went through, and it won't prevent the next one. We have the Treasury ever more deeply involved in the regulation of banks, which is which is really problematic because we should, in my view, we shouldn't have political agencies trying to regulate banks. That we should have an independent agencies overseeing our banking system that are not part of the political process. I think we have way too many agencies. I think our supervisory system is fragmented. And I had hoped that we would have, Senator Dodd in November of 2009 introduced legislation in which he would have created a federal banking commission and merged the OCC and the Fed and the controllers and the OTS supervisory things authorities together into an agency that would be responsible for all banks and thrifts, all federally chartered banks, thrifts, and holding companies. I was very much in favor of that. I had hoped we would have an independent FDIC, and I endorsed Dodd's bill, subject to the FDIC being left as an independent watchdog. And I had hoped that we would create an independent systemic risk council, which we didn't do. We let the Treasury be in charge of the systemic risk council, and the board members are the very agencies the systemic risk council should be overseeing. So the agencies are now looking at themselves and deciding whether they're doing a good job or not. That's not my idea of systemic risk watchdog.
Right.
So I'm not. And then I look at the amount of energy we spent over the past 2 years on a healthcare reform bill, and that's inordinately complex and expensive, runs up another $1 trillion on the federal deficit, and probably more. And all this energy we spent on this non-reform bill in the financial area, and I think, couldn't we have spent that time more wisely on trying to do things to get the economy on the mend? And specifically, we've got a deficit that's out of control and growing exponentially. We really have to deal with that. This crisis was brought about by excessive leverage in throughout the government and our private sector. And we're not doing anything to address those problems right now. Now we have this commission, and I hope something will happen. But it's hard to be optimistic right now. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with our country we can't fix, but I don't see very much political will to fix it. I'm not terribly optimistic right now. I think we'll eventually get it right because we've been through worse things than this, and we've come out of it stronger. So we'll figure it out. But it's painful. It's painful to see so many people losing their houses and their jobs, and politicians just not getting it. So that's how I feel about where we are right now.
Uh-huh. Right.
How's your business?
Well, my business tends to be a little counter-cyclical. The more problems people have, the more they want to come to me. But I'd rather be working less hard and have things be more normal for most of the country.
What do you hear about would be interested. You, one of the things that you did that was very good in your book, I thought very clear sighted, was that most people act like agencies are. That agencies act normally, that like the OTC does this or the OTS does this or the OCC did that. But one of the things that you did very specifically in your book is make it clear that there were the individuals running these agencies that had their own individual points of view, and then they get the agencies to do as they see is the appropriate thing to do. The sense of the power of the individual inside the organizations. When you look at our landscape now, could you comment on how well you think some of the major players did?
I tried really, really hard throughout. I mean, I as you know, because you've been reading some of my things, and that I've had a a practice of being very open and honest about my views of things, and I'm not afraid to criticize something that I think is taking us in the wrong direction. But one thing I have always tried to do is to never personalize it, and not to criticize the individuals so much as the actions they have taken, the policies they have pursued. So I'm not really going to go there in terms of evaluating people. What I would say is that individuals can have a great impact. I think Paul Volcker, for example, had a great impact on the Fed, and a very positive impact. He's one of my heroes. But there are people who can also make bad decisions, and the agency heads are not infallible. And sometimes you have very good ones who make some very good decisions, and other times you have some not so good ones who make some pretty serious mistakes. And for that reason, I believe it is very important to have a system that has checks and balances in it. That's why when Senator Dodd proposed to merge all these agencies together, including the FDIC, I said, basically, that's a good idea in my view, but I think it would be a serious mistake to put the FDIC in that agency and not have it remain as an independent watchdog on the system, because people are going to make mistakes, and the fewer hands you put the decision making into, and you don't have proper watchdogs, checks and balances, that those mistakes can get very, very big. So that's why I've been adamant about my dislike for the structure, the regulatory structure that they came up with for the regulatory system in this reform bill. You know, I was at one of the agencies the other day, and speaking with a pretty high-level person there, and he said that this person said that under Dodd-Frank, all of the agencies are responsible for everything, and therefore no one is accountable. And this was a person, a high-level person in one of the agencies complaining about this, that because we are under this mishmash they created, with having all of the agencies come together and meet in their systemic risk councils and all these different things they created, nobody can be said to be in charge of something. This is so when things go awry, there's no one to blame. It's hard to figure out how to fix it because you don't know. It was a group decision. I really think that it's not productive to criticize an individual. I mean, yeah, there's some individuals who do their job very well and they're heroes, and there are some who make some bad decisions and they're goats, but that's not the point. The point is you ought to have a system that doesn't put the fate of the country in the hands of individuals, as opposed to having a system that has some checks and balances and safeguards.
Well, I understand what you're saying. I guess one of the things that's notable about what happened, though, is that, in fact, nobody has been disciplined or lost their jobs because of what happened.
Almost everybody who created this crisis is still in power in the private and public sector.
And they have even more power.
Right.
I mean, nobody's been held accountable for this.
Do you think the motivation and incentive to become a regulator is different today from when you became a regulator?
Not sure how it would be different. I mean, I think it's different for different people. In the different stages of life, different people might have different motivations. I don't know of anything that's really changed today that would make it make me think that there's it would change motivations that people have.
Well, indeed, you described very clearly a kind of culture that you were dealing with the FDIC and with the other agencies. But when you come to Washington now, does it seem like culture of the regulatory agencies has changed?
I'm sorry, I didn't follow that.
Well, when you talk about your experience with the FDIC, and of course you interacted with a lot of the other regulatory agencies, you know, having dealt with some crises yourself, when you think back to that and what the mood was like, do you see a difference in the culture in Washington today at those agencies than what there was then?
I don't think so. I mean, it's a little difficult right now at this time to look at the way the agencies are today versus the way they were in 1990 or the way they were even in 2005. We are right now I would say that the agencies are overwhelmed with work right now, and they are scared they feel like everybody's blaming them for the problems that we're in, and what are they going to do about it, and are they going to make it worse, and or are they going to make it better, and what are you going to do with all these regulatory requirements that the Dodd-Frank bill imposes on the agencies? So I think right now everybody's overworked, and they're very nervous about the financial system and what's going on, and they don't want to make it worse, but yet they've got all these laws they've got to implement, and I think they feel like they're sort of damned if they do and damned if they don't. But that is a function of this current climate we're in, not so much a function of the job itself.
Mike, did you?
I think I've developed a much better way of asking the question. And from what Kirsten said, it may be that you've covered this already, so please stop me if you have. You mentioned that Paul Volcker had a tremendous influence on the Fed, and that he was your hero. Could you elaborate on that? What sort of influence he had?
Well, first of all, he became chairman of the Fed at a time when inflation was out of control,
right?
And he had the courage to do what it took to get it under control and to stand firm in that, despite all of the incredible devastation it was causing. I mean, he raised interest rates to 21.5%,
right?
It was causing borrowers throughout the country to go bankrupt, and financial institutions were failing left and right because of it. But yet he had the courage to know it had to be done, and he did it, and he held firm. Number one, I was very impressed. Remain impressed to watch a guy be willing to take that kind of strong action in the face of all that intense criticism, and do what was right, what he believed to the core was right. And he didn't say, well, I wasn't going to bail out Wall Street.
Right.
he did what he needed to do in order to get inflation under control, and then limit the damage as best he could to the financial system. You also see it in his intellect. He's very smart, very wise, and he did seek the opinions of others, which is, you know, sometimes people who are very smart think they're too smart, and they don't reach out to others. That was not his style. And then he also had a healthy distrust of the perhaps too much, but of the private sector. He really felt that there was an important role for regulation, because if you didn't control the system, if you didn't have good regulation, that greed would get out of control. And he was not afraid to do that, despite the political objections he got. That if he felt that it was necessary to regulate a certain way, more capital, whatever it was, he would do that, and he'd take the heat and not worry about it.
Okay. So, I mean, the main thing I was looking for was in terms of, I had thought that you had been speaking about changing the culture or changing the direction of the Fed, or, you know, the way that people went about their jobs. And it seems to me that you've answered that to some extent, that there was a greater push towards regulation or greater skepticism of the private sector.
That's true, but, you know, the Fed didn't need as much change at that time as the FDIC.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the FDIC had not been used essentially for 50 years.
Right.
In resolving bank failures, and when there was a failure of any note, the Treasury and the Fed told the FDIC what to do, and the FDIC saluted and did it. And as I point out in the book, that was not my vision for the FDIC. The FDIC was an important watchdog, and we needed to develop the personnel and the systems and everything at the FDIC so that it could play that role. There was a need for a strong FDIC, prior to that time, the FDIC had not fulfilled that role. And so we did have to make a lot of changes. I'm not sure that Volcker had to make that many changes.
Okay. What about Todd Conover at the OCC?
What about him?
I mean, in terms of, did he bring about any cultural or policy changes that you thought were noteworthy?
Well, one of the things he decided to do was reform the exam process, and it was very controversial. He wanted to rely less on examiners going in and counting, you know, looking at particular assets and counting the cash and the things that they always did, and have them come in instead and look at the way the banks were being run from the top on down, and the systems in place. And that was very controversial at the time. I know a lot of folks at the FDIC didn't like it at all, because it seemed that people weren't paying enough attention to the quality of the assets in the banks, and instead were much more focused than they needed to be on the management systems and processes. I think he was right, but I think he might have gone a little bit too far in that direction. What you really need is both. And you can't ignore taking a good hard look at the quality of those assets on an ongoing basis. But also, I think he had it right when he said that he was going to be much more concerned about the quality of management and the quality of the management systems and governance processes in place. And in fact, that change lives today. And That's a normal part of bank supervision now, including by the FDIC, that didn't exist before Todd Conover started raising those issues.
Right. And how about the Federal Home Loan Bank Board? I'm drawing a blank on who was in charge of that during your tenure, but I remember something about him not getting along with Don Regan. That's about the best. What do you think the effect?
Well, when I first was there, it was Dick Pratt,
mm-hmm.
Who was a he was the head of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, appointed by Reagan, and then about I'm going to say somewhere around 1984, Ed Gray,
right,
became the chairman of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board.
And what influence do you think that they had on their agencies?
I think they. I was, as I said in the book, I was pleasantly surprised with Ed Gray because he didn't come in with a regulatory background. He was a marketing executive, as I recall, and worked in the Reagan White House. And I didn't think he would have I didn't think he'd have a whole lot of spine coming in, but he actually did take on the industry on some issues and tried to get things under control. So I would give him I'd give him strong marks. The problem is he didn't last very long. He didn't stay very long, and it's hard to have an impact on an agency if you're changing leaders every two or three years. I had the benefit of having come to the FDIC. I was a Carter appointee to the Republican seat. It was a bipartisan board in 1978. So I had a couple of years to get to know the agency. They got to know me before I became chairman. And then I spent, I can't remember, I think it was 5 years as chairman. And altogether, I was there 8 years. That if you are at an agency in one of those leadership roles for 8 years, you can have an impact.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're just sort of passing through, and you spend 2 or 3 years there, it's highly unlikely you're going to have a big impact because the agency's not going to respond to you until they get to know you better. And until you get to know them better.
Right. And I was curious about the relationship between regulators and Congress during this period. And maybe I will make it a little bit more specific by saying I'm puzzling out. In some cases, it seems like the regulators are pushing Congress towards more deregulation. And in other cases, it seems like Congress is taking the initiative. And so I'd like any sort of insight that you might have on that dynamic, whether one was more important than the other or how it worked out in practice.
I believe that the... I'm trying to figure out how to say this. I believe that both the regulators and the Congress were largely reactive, not proactive.
Okay.
Let's take the deposit interest rate controls. With the prime rate at 21.5%, we had this law since the Depression that limited the amount of interest banks could
No, I understand. Depository Institutions Deregulation and Monetary Control Act. It's a mouthful.
Right. But we had a committee. I'm trying to remember what the committee was.
Oh.
I don't remember. But anyway, the prime rate went to 21.5%, and money market funds and mutual funds were invented, and negotiable CDs and all these things, there was something had to be done because the banks and SNLs were losing their deposits. They were being disintermediated, and so they rammed through in a hurry the interest rate decontrol law and set up this committee to oversee the phasing out of interest rate controls. That was done in reaction to what had already happened in the economy and in the financial system. There was no choice, and unfortunately, it was too little, too late. I believe it was 1972, President Nixon appointed the Hunt Commission to look at the thrift industry and to figure out what needed to be done to keep it viable and to modernize it. And the Hunt Commission came up with, it was called the Hunt Commission, they came up with some recommendations. They were spot on. They were the things that needed to be done, and ultimately they were done, but not until we had the S&L crisis. And so, I mean, there are people who look ahead and say, well, we need to fix this. Let's take Social Security or Medicare. They're going to bankrupt the country if we don't get them under control. People know that. We've known it for years and years and years. But I think there's a reluctance to do something until you have to do it. We seem to wait till there's a crisis. And then we rush through a bunch of changes, and sometimes the right changes and sometimes not. So I don't think the regulators and the Congress lead change very much. I think they react to changes that occur in the economy.
Okay. Now, in terms of policy choices, one of the decontrol of interest rates was one, but you could also think about perhaps...
I just remembered, wasn't it DIDIC?
Something like that. Washington loves acronyms.
I think it was DIDIC.
Okay.
I was a member of that.
Right. Where was I? On the several policy options, what struck me was that the way that mutual funds were allowed to work is that they had a contract with their investors that was very much like a deposit. You get all your money back, if it hasn't broken the buck, and it's first come, first serve. You could make different policy choices to, say, restrict what money market mutual funds could do. You could also take the opposite and say, okay, this is the direction we're going. Don't worry so much about the banks. Maybe they're dying out or what have you. Why was the actual policy decided upon that happened, do you think?
You mean phasing out interest rate controls?
Phasing out interest rate controls, but more broadly, supporting the bank industry while at the same time allowing these money markets to continue their business in this sort of hybrid fashion.
Well, what happens is some lawyer gets a bright idea of a way around a restriction. And the other thing that happens is technology changes so you couldn't have money market funds without computers.
Right.
Technology changes, communications and computer technology changes to make new things possible. And lawyers look at laws and they try to figure out ways around them. And the marketplace develops new products that threaten the old order. And, you know, we don't really want to stand in the way of that because that's one of the things that makes the country great. And one of the great strengths of the free enterprise system, talk about it, it's creative destruction.
Right.
And so people invent these new things. They find ways around the impediments, the legal impediments to it, and the product gets established and it builds its own constituency.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, it's almost impossible to roll it back politically because a whole bunch of people have money market funds and they love it, and they're not going to give them up.
Okay.
And so then you have to go back to the institutions that are impacted by that, and you say, okay, now what do we do? What do we need to do to make them viable in this new world? And sometimes they can adapt, and sometimes they can't. Many of the SNLs couldn't adapt, and they went out of business. They failed. And many of the banks couldn't adapt. For 50 years, the banks were in a very controlled competitive environment in which they were told what they could pay for their deposits. They were told where they could branch. It was very difficult to get a new bank charter. The competition was, they were told what they could do, what type of loans they could make, what kinds of activities they could be involved in. And so the environment they were in was a very tightly controlled competitive environment. And then in the 1960s and the 1970s, things became unglued because of all these innovations. And the banks were then all of a sudden thrust in the 1982 law into competing. They had to compete based on price, and they got more freedom to do different things, and a lot of them couldn't make it in that environment. They were in a time warp. For 50 years, they really didn't have to change very much. And then all of a sudden, I'll give you an example. Of the 25 largest banks in 1980 in this country, I may be wrong, but I believe only two of them are left. Can you imagine that? The 25 largest banks in 1980, only two of them are left. And little NCNB, and it was a $4 billion North Carolina bank in the early 70s. NCNB was a $4 billion North Carolina bank. It is today the Bank of America.
Right.
If somebody had told me in the early 70s that NCNB was going to wind up being the largest bank in the country, or one of the largest at least, and with probably the best banking franchise in the world, I would have wondered what you were smoking when you told me that.
Right. Now, but you mentioned creative destruction, and then you went on immediately to something that sort of perked my interest. Then you said, then you go to the banking industry and help them, figure out how they can adapt. Perhaps the way, at least under creative destruction, you would say, okay, well, perhaps they go by the wayside.
Well, I don't have a problem with people going by the wayside if they can't cut it. But if you've got a bunch of laws and restrictions in place that are preventing them from meeting this new competitive threat, then I think you have to, appropriate. You have to clear those out so they have a decent chance. You can't tie both their hands behind their back and say, okay, go ahead and get in the ring and see how you do.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, hi. Can I just bring it back to something you talked about earlier? We can wrap this up fairly soon, I think. Mark-to-market accounting and its role in the crisis. And I've read your comments in the book, so I have read that, so forgive me. I just would like to sort of talk for a moment on the record about it. How do you think the history of the crisis might have looked if we had abandoned beforehand mark-to-market accounting?
Oh, I believe that... clearly, we wouldn't have had hundreds of billions of dollars of capital destroyed, which represented $500 billion of capital was destroyed in the financial system in 2008, and banks can loan about $8 for every dollar of capital, so that's about $4 trillion of lending capacity that was destroyed. I feel certain that the recession wouldn't have been as deep without that destruction of capital. And we're still feeling the effects of it because we're not letting these banks, we're all over these banks now to rebuild their capital. And if you're being told by your regulator to rebuild capital, you're not going to make a whole lot of new loans. In fact, you're probably going to be shrinking your balance sheet in order to get into compliance with their new with the capital ratio requirements. So I think that there's no doubt in my mind that it made the recession worse. But it probably, I feel also relatively certain that it caused a tremendous amount of psychological destruction or damage. These banks around the country were reporting huge losses, and they were undermining confidence in the system when you see somebody reporting that they lost $20 billion in the last quarter, and it was a paper loss. It wasn't a real economic loss. It was a loss on paper. They had to write instruments down. I have some charts I could send you. I looked at assets, 11 categories of financial assets, and how they performed during the crisis. And the subprime mortgage loans did the worst. They went from about 100 cents on the dollar down to about 40, and other forms of assets, you know, credit card loans and different kinds of loans, went down in varying degrees. But it's really interesting because they went down in a really deep V, and then they went back up to almost 100 cents in the dollar. The subprime mortgage loans are now around, last I looked, it was around 83 cents in the dollar. So they didn't get back to 100, but pretty close. And the others are all much closer to 100 cents in the dollar. And the distance in time from the original 100 cents in the dollar to the recovery was about 6 months. So there was about a 6 month long trough there, where there was simply no market because the markets panicked,
right,
and nobody wanted to buy anything, and so and by requiring banks to write off $500 billion of capital, in that artificially, to these artificial market prices that virtually didn't exist. We did an enormous amount of damage, both to the capital as well as to the public psychology.
That does make sense to me, but I'm not sure how to reconcile it with comments from sources at Bank of America, at Goldman, and at Bank of America, Goldman, one other, that said mark-to-market was not a problem. It did not exacerbate the crisis.
First of all, you have to take Goldman. Goldman loves mark-to-market accounting, and so just take everything they say with a grain of salt. Goldman loves mark-to-market accounting. I don't know why they love it, but I would tell you that there are some of the biggest fans of mark-to-market accounting are people who are short sellers and speculators. They love the chaos in the markets, and they make a lot of money in the middle of chaos. So some of the hedge funds and other people who are short sellers, and they made a fortune. There were people who made billions and billions of dollars in this market where there was no market, and. So you really have to take that with a grain of salt.
Right.
Talk to Sheila Bair, see what she thinks about mark-to-market. I actually read her interview in Forbes, and she said there's no question that mark-to-market was a severe problem.
Right. I read some of her comments. That is very helpful.
Go talk to Wells Fargo and ask them what they think of mark-to-market accounting. I don't know what Bank of America has said about it. I haven't seen that. But the banking industry was paying taxes throughout this period on income because the IRS did cash accounting and wouldn't take into account the mark-to-market losses. And so the banking industry in the period of this crisis was actually paying substantial taxes.
So you had tax authorities ignoring mark-to-market and the SEC insisting on mark-to-market.
Exactly. Go ahead and talk. I'm looking right now in my...
If you want to just quickly give me your email address, I'll shoot you an email. Someone else has it here, but if you give it to me, then I'll send you an email and you'll have it to send me anything back. But you do think, but as far as trading assets go, you think mark-to-market is fine for that?
If the assets are in a trading portfolio, they are inventory and they ought to be marked to current prices. I believe that.
What about obstacles to sort of moving assets back and forth that could be a kind of a game with mark-to-market?
Well, clearly you have to deal with that. I mean, and we do. I mean, banks can't go willy-nilly going back and forth.
Right.
It's like, you know, when a company decides it wants to be a subchapter S corp, it can't go 1 year it's going to be subchapter S, the next year it's going to be C corp, and then back to subchapter S. I mean, you make an election and you got to stick with it.
Right. No, I agree with that. Asset category is a little bit more subtle though than subchapter S versus other.
I agree. But I'm just saying they have rules and they can deal with it.
Right. 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 Well, I think that pretty much wraps it up for me. You've been extremely helpful. I appreciate
yes.
it.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Okay. So, and if you send me an email, I will try to... I'm looking for this... I actually have a chart that shows what the banks paid in income taxes during during this crisis. And it's quite stunning to see that the IRS doesn't believe in margin market and their taxes.
I think that could be very helpful to me. So I will send you an email as soon as we get out of this meeting. But thanks again. You were really helpful, and good luck. And if we have more questions, we'll get back to you.
Well, anytime, and I hope you guys are going to do I'm counting on you to do great work. I really am. I think it's... I'm only disappointed that the Congress saw fit to adopt legislation before hearing from you.
Yeah, well, that's the way things work here, I guess.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Take care, bye.